Radio.
The Beauty and Inspiration of the Bible. A series of talks on the Bible in Contemporary Scholarship by Dr. Robert Tilley at St. Francis of Assisi Parish in Paddington, Sydney. This first talk is entitled, From Eden to New Eden, The Torah and the Tabernacle.
Look, in a way, you could say that in reading the scripture, it's a little bit like a transition, and the transition begins something like this. In Proverbs, it says that wisdom begins with the fear of God. And then we might jump, as it were, to St. Paul, where he says twice, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. And the goal of such, we might say, is what St. John writes in one of his letters, that perfect love casts out fear. The problem, I think, is that in our modern world, we want to jump all the way straight to the apprehension and experience of love. And I think that has ruined many a soul. Though it does well, I guess, for our consumer economy. The question then is really where to begin properly so. Now, what I want to do in this next 3 weeks, if some of those of you are hardy enough to go through the 3 weeks, is actually trying to paint not only a contemporary picture of where a lot of modern biblical scholarship is at, but also to apply it, which is a rather difficult thing to do. And I think the best place to begin is with the notion of beauty. The notion of beauty. If we look at the Psalms, and I've only given just three examples from the Psalms, there's plenty of others. If we look at the Psalms, which of course represent the liturgy and the worship of ancient Israel, and that has come down through the synagogue and into the church. If we look at the Psalms, which derive from the temple liturgy, the theme of beauty recurs. Psalm 110, verse 3, your people will be willing in the day of your might, in the beauty of your holiness. Your people will be willing in the day of your might, in the beauty of your holiness. As is usually the case with Hebrew poetry and indeed prose, there's a parallelism there. And it's interesting that might is in parallel with beauty. God's might is synonymous with his beauty and both with his holiness. Psalm 27, verse 4. I will seek my dwelling in the house of God to behold the beauty of Yahweh. I will seek my dwelling in the house of God to behold the beauty of Yahweh. Psalm 29, verse 2. Worship Yahweh in beauty of holiness, and so on. God is beautiful, the temple is beautiful, worship is beautiful, and all of this somehow is around the liturgy. The meaning of religion and the meaning of transcendence has to do with beauty. And this includes the sacred text. Now, quite clearly, the canon of the Bible, both the Jewish and the Christian canon of the Bible, come a lot later from when the Psalms were written, as a lot of the things were written in the Bible. The canon comes a lot later, and yet such is a case of divine inspiration. They come together in order to form what is quite a wonderful unity, which I hope to show. The sacred text is beautiful, but how does beauty show itself? And this is the problem. The problem is in our consumer age, or indeed any age, is that we can confuse beauty with kitsch. With kitsch, which that is mass-produced or captured in something easily commodified and easily consumed. In other words, we confuse, as I stress, beauty with kitsch. Consequently, we might take as an example supermodels or like contrivance. With supermodels, it's a very interesting theme that they look incredibly standardized and actually without any kind of sensuality. There's a kind of impression of beauty and indeed of sex, and yet really there seems to be nothing. They're kitsch. But beauty has subtlety and charm, and beauty has fear, even fear. Personally, when I think of, say, an example of beauty, of, say, a celebrity many years ago, would have been Björk. Björk, a singer, had very quirky looks and at times just incredibly astoundingly beautiful, and yet at other times something almost ugly. There was an ambivalence to it, something uncanny. Beauty has subtlety and charm, and yet it also has fear. For without fear, we have kitsch. In Western aesthetics, we know this. Beauty has to do with the whole, the sum of the whole. And yet it also has something more. So beauty has something to do with the whole, and yet something more. And often in literary studies, that something more is often referred to as the uncanny. And in fact, in 18th century aesthetics, it was often referred to as, and this actually by the grand progenitor, I guess, of Western liberal politics, Edmund Burke, in his work on the sublime, terror. How does this relate to the scriptures? Well, I'm only going to give a potted history for the moment, but there has been a revolution, I should say, in biblical criticism in the last 40 to 50 years. The old-style modern biblical criticism has been severely critiqued. Possibly many of you many years ago might have gone and learnt that the Pentateuch, quite confidently, was made up of a number of different documents, JEDP and so forth, or that Matthew's Gospel, quite confidently, came from Antioch in 80 AD, blah, blah, blah. Well, forget that. Everything's up for grabs. The certainties of modernity have been severely critiqued, not just, of course, in biblical criticism, but with the rise of post-modernity, for want of a better term, many of those certainties have been cast away, and a good thing too, in my opinion. Modern biblical criticism really took its rise in the late Renaissance in the 16th and 17th centuries. And from its very beginning, it was tied up with modern nationalism and, unfortunately, modern racialism and anti-Semitism. It largely came about through the deliberate aim to divorce the Bible from the Catholic Church. Not just the Reformers, but later on in the English establishment, especially the English establishment, because modern biblical criticism proper arose in England. It later took up on the continent with the likes of Spinoza, but it had its real foundings in the rise of secular nationalism in England, and the rise, I guess, of the secular state having power over the faith. It's nothing new to say that modern biblical criticism has been, since its inception, entwined with the cultural power of modern nationalism and, in fact, the rise of modern capitalism through liberal progressivism. The problem with modern biblical criticism, one that actually was within biblical criticism itself, was fragmentation. Again and again, when the biblical critics address a biblical text, any biblical text, what happened was they started to say, well, look, we can detect all these fractures, all these fragments, and all these different sources. And all these different sources come from different times and periods and so on and so forth. And consequently, we fragment the text, and through our understanding, we build it all back up again. Now, let's get it clear. Of course, the Bible is comprised of documents and sources. The Pentateuch especially, not least because it tells us so. But many of the so-called documents and sources that biblical critics posited were arbitrary, were made up, were nothing more than the product of, I guess, a febrile imagination. And believe me, this was understood within the discipline. It was a great problem. Thus, in the 18th century, it was actually called the fragmentary hypothesis. A Scottish fellow, actually a lapsed priest by the name of Alexander Geddes, championed it. But that was a problem. The text was getting fragmented. So people, especially in Germany, posited what was called a documentary hypothesis, especially in reference to the Torah or the Pentateuch. And they tried to cease the fragmentation, but alas, it did not, and it got worse. Later, a fellow called Hermann Gunkel posited form criticism with the attempt to again try to unite, but that too failed, and so on and so forth. I'll come back to some of that history in the next couple of weeks, because it's the so-called liberal lives of Jesus that took off in the 19th century in Germany are a case in point. They're sentimental, liberal, and virulently anti-Semitic. The fragmentation that attended modern biblical critical study was itself an expression of modernity. Consequently, in the 1950s, a movement started to rise out more to the literary secular universities, and it started to critique modernity, as I said, and especially modern biblical criticism. And then in the 60s and 70s, the criticism really took off. And we had the rise of what is called rhetorical criticism, narrative criticism, and canonical criticism, all of which accent the structure, the unity of the text. As I say, a good deal of this current arose from secular literary departments. Indeed, one still finds, unfortunately, in certain parts of Australia, an incredible ignorance of these developments. Well, I hope from this short series to present something of what is going on. But let's say this: contemporary biblical criticism is actually rediscovering what the church fathers and rabbis knew. That the scriptures are incredibly skillfully and subtly written and compiled. And in fact, they have been structured in levels or grades. Seemingly simple accounts contain meanings that incredibly astound when you actually pay attention to the way the text is structured. How ought we to understand the structure of the Bible? The Church Fathers championed a way which was called, for want of a better term, the quadriga. Now, the quadriga referred to four levels of meaning, but in point of fact, some held to three meanings, some to seven, some to nine, some to 14 levels of meaning. Among the rabbis, there was an equivalent, and it goes under the acronym of Pardesh, which actually is Hebrew for orchard. The Pardesh too signified four levels of meaning, probably more meanings, levels. But here's the thing. Those were graded meanings. And those graded meanings weren't opposed to each other, but they were hierarchical. And being hierarchical, they could contain otherness and difference within a continuity. And what they mirrored was this. The temple, or earlier, the tabernacle. The idea was this: we come to realize more and more, for example, one scholar, Mary Douglas, in her work Leviticus as Literature, argues that if you read Leviticus, which is in the first five books of the Bible, The way in which it's artfully structured with its parallels and so on and so forth mirrors the temple as you go from the outer court of the temple through into the holy place and into the Holy of Holies where the presence of God was said to reside. Well, that structure of tabernacle or temple is the structure of how they understood not just a sacred text, not just a liturgy, but in fact the whole cosmos. That wasn't something just that Israel had, because it was a general theme throughout the ancient Near East. The idea was that the temple was a microcosm of the macrocosm of the cosmos, and consequently, as through the temple, so too through the cosmos, space and time are hierarchically graded in a continuity. And so too the sacred text. So that when I opened up by saying, quoting from the Psalms, about the notion of beauty being absolutely essential to the notion of God, of temple, of worship, of liturgy, then you can start to see why the understanding of beauty is therefore absolutely essential to the reading of the text that is sacred. One of the problems we confront, and one of the things I do often in classes at the Catholic Institute of Sydney and other classes, Aquinas and so forth, is to try and make a point about the way in which we read. Now, perhaps you could imagine, I'm not going to carry them around, I'm sorry, I've just come from work, but let's say I've gone down to the local bookshop, whichever one's still open, I go down there and I buy a number of sacred texts. Let's say I buy a copy of one of Buddhism's most holy texts, the Lotus Sutra, Penguin Classics, I buy that, get a copy of the Rig Veda, one of the oldest, most holiest aspects of Hinduism, and let's say a copy of Zen Flesh, Zen Bones, a collection of Zen koans, and the Bible. Now I purchase those and I come here and I put them there, and I could say, what is common to them all? And in class, people usually say things, well, they're books, or they have sacred meaning, and so on and so forth, all of which are right. But there's something else common to them all that we don't notice, and that's a problem with our reading. And in a way, it's a problem by which we don't get the sense of the sacred. And what's common to them all is simply, they have been mass published, mass disseminated, disembedded from their sacred communion. That's not why they were written. The Bible wasn't written for that. It might still be the bestseller, but it was not written to be indiscriminately disseminated. It was written for the church, or the synagogue, as case may be. The Rig Veda certainly was not meant for everybody. It was meant for the Brahmanical caste, and only a specific body of that caste, and so on and so forth. Now, whether right or wrong, the problem is, it means we go and we purchase a sacred text and we think, I have a right as a punter, as a consumer, to consume it. But you lose the sense of the sacred approach, and you lose the sense of the beauty with that. Suddenly the sacred text becomes something like a supermodel. Well, what I want to do tonight is to set the pace and to start to look at the unity of the Bible, of the Christian Bible. And we might begin with Genesis chapters 1 to 3, the accounts of creation and the fall. Let's just note something about it. We're in Eden, and then, of course, Adam and Eve are expelled from Eden, and they are prevented from eating of the tree of life. Now, however we read the account is by the point. And I might point out here that St. Augustine, in his Confessions, for example, when he starts to look at the first verses of Genesis, shakes his head in wonder, because he says, look, there are so many equally orthodox readings of these verses. How can that be? And he concludes, well, the text is really ultimately inspired by God, who is illimitable. So any text inspired by God must have illimitable meaning. And for the Church Fathers, a literal reading of Genesis 1 was acceptable, but it was often considered to be a carnal reading, a surface reading. So, what we're reading is the narrative of the text as it stands. And if we begin in chapters 1 to 3, we begin in Eden, and then we begin expelled from Eden, and we are denied access to the Tree of Life. When we go to the end of the Christian Bible, to the book of Revelation, a journey has ended and we are in the new Eden. The new Jerusalem, the bride of Christ, the church, has come down from heaven, as it's described, and merged with the earthly temple, the earthly Jerusalem. There's a merging of heaven and earth. And we are in the new Eden, which is depicted as a new temple, albeit a temple that has no partitions or walls. And there in this new Eden, in this new Jerusalem, in this new temple, what do we see? Well, in Revelation chapter 22, verses 1 to 2, what we see first is a river flowing out of it. And of course, that points back to Genesis, because that's what we're told in Genesis chapter 2, verse 10, that a river flows out of Eden. It's a theme that Ezekiel, the prophet, takes up in his vision of the new temple, this river flowing out of the new Jerusalem, which is the new Eden. Well, in Revelations, there it is, the river flowing out. We're also told in Revelation that there is the Tree of Life. Now the Tree of Life is accessible. In other words, what you see in the Christian Bible is clearly a unity, at least, of beginning and end. Or, as Revelations might put it, Alpha and Omega. The point is this, though. What the Bible contains all through, in both the Old and New Testaments, the Hebrew and Christian Bibles, is a major overarching theme that informs every step of the way. And I use that term, every step of the way, with intention. The overarching theme of the Bible is from Eden to the new Eden, is the journey. Now let's note something, because it's often some of the most significant thing about reading texts, and especially the Bible, is to actually see what it does not do, what is not present. The Bible does not do nostalgia. The Bible does not do nostalgia. There's no going back prior to the fall. There's no going back, as you might put it, to the womb. It does not do nostalgia. Nostalgia is actually a feature of modernity. I guess when you lose faith, all you've got to really believe in is something past. We'll return to something of this in the next 2 weeks. But there's another development that the Bible shows us. First, let's go over it. The Bible is from Eden to the new Eden. There is a teleological, or you might say eschatological, that is, it's oriented to a goal, to a purpose, to a meaning, to a fulfillment. And now there's a development as well that you will see in the Bible itself as well, vis-a-vis our relationship to God. Now, when we look at Genesis in the first three chapters, what we see is a picture of God walking in the cool of the evening in the garden, being very, very friendly, you know, with Adam and Eve, being their friends. But what we see at the close of the Bible is something very different. What were once friends are now lovers. Because in point of fact, what we see with humanity in respect of the church is that we are now the bride of Christ. We have gone from being friends to lovers of God. And that's why I started off by saying, when we look at the Bible, there's that theme. Proverbs, Beginning of wisdom is the fear of God. St. Paul, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. And then 1 John, when it looks to the culmination of all things, perfect love casts out all fear. There is an overarching theme found in the Torah itself, that is in the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch. What we see as a principle throughout the Bible is a theme of recapitulation. I'm going to explain it in a little bit now. The Bible paints a picture of all of humanity as journeying, as wandering. And yet, in smaller parts of the Bible, for example, the Torah, there is a microcosmic representation of that journeying by reference to Israel. But the best way to explain this is by detailing it. I want to focus on the Torah in what's left of this time, because I want to bring out how the biblical writers were divinely inspired in executing their craft. The theme of the Torah, of course, begins with Genesis, the expulsion from Eden. It is a journey to the promised land. Now, when we read the promises in the Torah as it goes through to the Exodus, again and again, the theme that is repeated from Abraham on, at least, is a land flowing with milk and honey. And that theme of fruitfulness and fecundity is a major theme that defines life in the Bible, that defines Eden, that defines, in fact, beauty. So the idea that's presented in the Torah is that here you have the expulsion from Eden and from fertility and fecundity, and now is the hope of the promise of the promised land in which it will again be fruitful and fecund. Only, here's the really interesting part about the Torah. You go through this incredible journey and you don't get there. It ends on the threshold. It ends with Moses dying, just being able to look at it from afar. And in fact, it ends in a really quite an awful way, because as Moses is basically close to death, God says, well, in point of fact, they've been really, really horrible, all the Israelites. And in point of fact, they're going to be no better when they actually get to the land. And in fact, they're going to get worse, and they'll be in exile, and they'll have to wander again. The interesting thing is here is the plebeian Philistine nature of modern biblical criticism prior to the 1950s. Believe you me, for the last 20, 30 years I've studied modern biblical criticism, and again one can only shake one head in dismay to think, who were these Philistines? So, for example, in the 1920s and 30s, it was posited by a number of German scholars, no, not least Alt and Gerhard von Rad, that it just wouldn't do. It just wouldn't do. The Pentateuch cannot end on the threshold. And so they posited a hexateuch of six books, saying Joshua originally belonged to the Pentateuch, because, of course, really, anyone with any sense writes a book that has a definite ending to it. We might reflect and think, what on earth would inform a conceit like that? Well, there's no evidence whatsoever for that position, not that that prevented them. It was just a sense that it must get to the goal. It must. But you see, in not getting to the goal, the author or authors of the Pentateuch were making a very strong point. And it's a point that is actually repeated a number of times in the Pentateuch itself, not least in respect of what is called the Akedah, Abraham's sacrifice of Isaac. It's a point in which almost there is no point except terror. But we'll return to the Akedah next week. Let's have a brief overview of the structure of Torah, because it gets really interesting if you read closely. After Adam and Eve are expelled from Eden, there is the first murder. Now I'll run through something very quickly. If you read Annals, actually the latest Annals actually has a column, because I do a column for it, and it has a column about this. So if you want to read more about it, you can see it in Annals. But simply put this, biblical critics used to argue that, look, the first chapter of Genesis is different to the second chapter in terms of creation account. Consequently, that contradiction must mean there were two different authors, two different sources. Well, we're not quite as unsophisticated as that anymore. We know fully well now that ancient peoples employed contradiction or apparent contradiction to make a point. What was the point the author was making? Well, when you read the first chapter of Genesis, what you find, seven times creation is called Tov, good, in Hebrew. And when humanity is created, it is created as male and female, that is, as communion. But in the second chapter, of course, only Adam, man alone, is created. And even though man alone has full communion with God and with the rest of creation, nevertheless, God says, it is lot tov, not good, for man to be alone. And thus, woman is made. Communion happens. What the author is pointing out is this. What does not goodness look like? What does the fall look like? It looks like the absence of communion, the sundering of communion. And at the fall, that's exactly what happens. After the fall, they cover their bodies, hide them from each other. That is not sexual, because they've been told to multiply. You cover your body because it's a sign of hiding. You are suspicious. You know good and evil. And the curses that arise from it are ones of division. Male and female divided, female and the animals, man and the earth. And this brings us to when they're expelled from Eden. The first thing that happens when they're expelled from Eden? Murder. Murder. Cain kills Abel, and as I often say, it's been murder ever since. Well, after Cain kills Abel, something very interesting happens. God meets Cain and gives him the mark to protect him. And he's told, you shall be a wanderer on the face of the earth. But what is the first thing that Cain does? Settles down and builds the first city. And he builds the first city and names it after his son, Enoch. In other words, he's starting to try to build a dynasty, an imperial power. To jump ahead, the violence grows and grows, and the Bible in Genesis presents two lines, one from a next son, Set. And what we find from Cain's line again and again is violence and imperial power, until, of course, we come to the time of Noah, and we are told that the sons of God, the great mighty heroes of old, went into the daughters of men. Now, of course, many will say, oh, they're angels or this or that. But in fact, the term sons of gods was an ancient Near Eastern appellation for great mighty kings. And the accent on daughters is plural. Harems is a sign of imperial power. The flood happens. And after the flood, we have Shem, Japhet, and Ham. And they're sent abroad. In other words, the cities have been destroyed in a flood, and now they're sent wandering. And what is the first thing that the Torah tells you happens after that? Humanity tries to stop the wandering and builds a city with a temple in it, Babel. And it says, let us build a temple to our name. Name always denotes, in those contexts of temple, the place of sacrifice and the god. So humanity makes of itself its own god, builds a temple in order to stop us being scattered abroad. They build a city. They're trying to stop the wandering. Of course, God comes down, scatters them, and then we have another genealogy. And that next genealogy is Shem's, and it ends on one family. And the family is a fellow by the name of Terah. And Terah lives in Ur, and Ur at this period is the grand megapolis, the Beijing, the New York, the London of the time. And Terah leaves with his family, and the implication is God has called him out. But here's the thing. He's going to go to Canaan, but he doesn't get there, and he ends up in Haran. And Haran is another big city. And it's then that just one of the members of Terah's family is called out. Abram, later to be Abraham. And Abraham is called out of the city to wander to the promised land of Canaan. And he wanders out with Lot, his cousin. And what is it that Lot does? Goes and settles on the cities of the plain. Again and again, the theme of settlement and then a kind of corruption and imperial power and violence recurs. And again, God has to call people out. And of course, that reaches its climax, as it were, in Egypt, where there you have the Israelites in Egypt for quite some time until they too are called out of Egypt. And they were only called out, ostensibly, for a few days. But here's the interesting thing, and I think here's an example of the kind of critique that the biblical writers do. I'm sure we all know the story of the dividing of the waters. They go through, get through safely, the Egyptians go through, and the great mighty imperial army is destroyed. And they come out the other side, the Israelites. And then in Exodus chapter 15, 1 to 21, that's when we have that glorious song by the people of Israel and Moses, all singing about how the horse and rider and everything is thrown into the sea, and how God is going to do such mighty things, such amazing things. And it's a glorious paean of praise and faith to God and this martial air. Now I would argue, and I would agree, that's a document, an earlier document that the author of the Torah has used. And he's used it with a purpose. Because what comes straight after? In fact, I think it was a reading on Sunday. Well, what comes a few days after is they begin to moan. And what is it? They moan. Well, what are we going to perish out here? God gives them that. A few weeks later, they're moaning again. And what is it they want to do? They want to return to the cities of Egypt. They don't want to wander into the wilderness. And of course, that means, well, they're going to have to wander for 40 years while that generation dies off. And then we're brought to the end of the Torah, to the end of Deuteronomy. And that's where, in a way, I began when we're talking about the Torah, with Moses dying on the threshold. By ending there, what the author of the Torah has done is pushed home that point. The journey isn't finished. It's not over. And even we learn that even when they go to the land, they will apostatize. And why is it they will apostatize? Largely because they'll take over the cities of Canaan, settle there, and start to get violent and bloodthirsty, and indeed even fight among themselves. The theme of journeying, of being cast out, being told to leave. In other words, Israel in the Torah is a kind of microcosm of the macrocosm of all humanity. Israel is a representative of all humanity. And this is something that we see borne out in the very way in which the Torah is structured. I just have to write this off. Okay. Sorry, that's probably not the best I can do. It's this. Among the documents that are clearly used in the Torah, probably the most major one is the Book of the Law, the Book of the Law of Moses. Now, the interesting thing, though, okay, so let's say there's the Book of the Law of Moses that represents, of course, the covenant at Sinai, because that's where the laws are given. But there's something even more. There's another covenant within that one, and that's the covenant of Aaron, the brother of Moses. And of course, that covenant has to do with priesthood. Now, here's the point. What the author has done is this. He's taken the Book of the Law of Moses, a lot of which is in Deuteronomy, but in other books as well, but he's taken the Book of the Law of Moses, which is representative of the covenant with Israel, and what the author has done is he's located it within a narrative history. And because he's done that, he's located that covenant within the Abraham covenant. Now that's very, very significant for a number of reasons. Certainly in Numbers, in the book of Numbers, it says that Israel is to be a nation of priests. Of course, all of them aren't going to be priests, but it means that the whole nation will act as a kind of representative mediator for who? Well, by reason that it's located within the Abraham covenant, we're told for who. Because the Abraham covenant goes like this. Through your seed, God says to Abraham, you will bless all the nations of the earth. By you will all the nations of the earth bless themselves. In other words, the theme is a blessing for others. Now here's the other thing. That Abraham covenant is actually placed within the context of the covenant with Noah. The covenant with Noah. And that covenant with Noah is made with all humanity. That's how it's represented. But if that were not enough, all of that is placed within the concept of the covenant with Adam. Adam is representative as a covenant, as a covenantal representative, like Moses was a covenantal representative of Israel. Adam was presented as a covenantal representative of all humanity and thereby of all creation, which is why when he fell, everything falls, because he's the covenantal representative. Now here's the point of the Torah. I would argue that, yes, quite plainly there are documents, there are historical documents in the Pentateuch that some author at whatever time has put together skillfully for some reason. And it would seem that one of those reasons is to remind Israel that we know in the Book of Kings and Chronicles and all that, again and again falls away, apostatizes, becomes self-referential rather than the idea of, well, we represent and serve all humanity. Rather, no, we serve ourselves. Well, whoever wrote it has written a narrative structure to show, look, these are the contexts. The context of the Torah is of all humanity. And that's why Israel, in a way, recapitulates all the history of humanity in the journeying. And we might think of our Lord in Matthew chapter 2, verse 15, when the Holy Family have to go to Egypt. And the author says, quoting Hosea chapter 11, verse 1, out of Egypt I called my son. Out of Egypt I called my son. Of course, that's a reference to calling Israel out of Egypt, who was said to be the Son of God. But of course, Jesus, as the covenantal representative, recapitulates the history of Israel and thereby the history of humanity. When we look at these themes in the Torah, what we're looking at is a theme of graded hierarchy. It is a priestly structure. As I guess most, if not all, scholars understand, the priestly structure informs not only the sacred text and the liturgy, but all creation. As I said, the temple is a microcosm of the macrocosm. But the point is about priesthood, of course, is this. In the person of the priest, in the person of the high priest like Aaron, when they go into the Holy of Holies once a year to make the Day of Atonement sacrifice, they represent all the Levites, all of Israel, and ultimately thereby all humanity. And here we might just finish with another point. The Pentateuch in the laws at Sinai forbid the making of an image of God. And yet, right at the beginning of the Torah, right at the beginning of the Torah, God makes an image of God, humanity. Consequently, it's actually a little bit wrong to say that Israelite religion was aniconic, totally without images of God. Because at least once a year, when the high priest went into the Holy of Holies, there was an image of God, by reason there was a human being in there. Why is the Torah structured that way? How does the rest of the Bible reflect that? How does it play upon that? How does it bring that out in this incredible narrative structure that is like a temple through which we go deeper and deeper? Well, next week what I want to do is to go to the prophets, in particular Isaiah. And in the final week, what I want to do is to come to the New Testament, especially St. John's Gospel, in order to show you how St. John has structured his Gospel in order to present a proto-Trinitarian theology. But look, I'll finish here for this week.
This was a talk by Dr. Robert Tilley entitled From Eden to New Eden, The Torah and the Tabernacle. This was the first of three talks from Dr. Tilley's series, The Beauty and Inspiration of the Bible. For more, visit cradio.org.au.